Hey, it's Kai Rizdahl, the host of Marketplace. You're listening to our podcast, Corner Office, where I get to talk to the people leading some of the companies you probably interact with or hear about every single day. Today, Sir Andrew Witty, the CEO of GlaxoSmithKline, the British pharmaceutical company that's in the top five or six biggest in the world. But from a public relations perspective, this probably isn't a great time to be in the big pharma industry. There are a whole lot of questions and concerns that people have when it comes to regulations and costs and the role that big pharmaceutical manufacturers play in the healthcare industry writ large. So let's get right to it.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Andrew Witty, good to have you with us.
Great to meet you.
You've been in pharmaceuticals a long time, 30-something years. And I wonder, through all the ups and downs, whether with Valeant, the company that's in a whole lot of trouble, and Martin Shkreli, the guy who bought the patent and jacked up the prices, and with the pressure from Congress about consumer prices on pharmaceuticals, I wonder if this is the roughest maybe that you've ever seen it.
It's certainly a period of extreme challenge. A lot of critics around, obviously. I would put it slightly differently.
Okay.
I also think this isn't a period which will just resort to the normal. So I think this is telling us things have to change. And certainly at GSK, we're very much focused on what has to change to really get back in sync with the views and expectations of the American people. I think it's easy sometimes to dismiss criticism as being one-off or there's a certain, you know, a special circumstance which creates that particular point. But there is clearly an issue here. People are concerned about affordability of healthcare overall. And they're concerned about different elements of that, including, of course, pharmaceuticals. Meanwhile, pharmaceutical companies, thousands and thousands of scientists are working every single day to try and come up with the next great breakthroughs. That's a good thing. We've got to find a way to get these things to sync back together so that people can be confident that they're going to get the treatments and the cures that they're hoping and praying for. We've got to work harder to make that happen.
There is a lot in that answer to unpack. So first of all, let's talk pricing. I mean, you are in a position where you can do something about this. What specifically are you doing? What do you have in mind that will make vital medications and pharmaceuticals more affordable for people who need them?
Well, at GSK, we've already been working on this. So for the last 7 or 8 years, we've spent a lot of time trying to reduce the costs of our R&D operations to try and make it less expensive to find these medicines. In fact, over the last several years, we've had more new drug approved than any other company by FDA in the US. Because we've been working hard on that, we've been able to bring the last six medicines, the last six major medicines that we've brought to the market here in the States, have been launched at or below the prices of the technologies that we aim to replace. So we're bringing tomorrow's generation of medicine at the same or lower prices than the prices of the products that have been around for 10 or 15 years. That's a real evidence, I think, of a company who are determined to try and resolve this. That's one point we can do. But the real way to solve this problem is a system issue. When we look at the whole of healthcare in the United States, 17 or 18% of GDP now spent on healthcare. It's an enormous cost. And of course, within that, you have pharmaceuticals, maybe 10 or 12% of the total budget, all hospital costs, all the other costs that we know exist. The problem in the US, bluntly speaking, is there's no transparency around what the real prices of everything is. So you have list prices of everything, including medicines, but everything else. And then there are discounts which are paid in the system to various intermediaries. So, for example, in the pharmaceutical industry at the moment in the US, it's not uncommon. In fact, it's probably the average that the average medicine has a 40% discount between the price we all see on the sticker, if you will, and the price that the system actually pays. The problem is nobody can really see that very easily. That means almost half of the price of the medicine is not going to the people who are doing the research. Now, we need to do something about that. I'm not saying that, and within what we need to do, we need to be thoughtful about should those list prices come down? Why have we got such a big difference between the list and the net price? How can that be helping efficiency in the system? So for me, the first step is transparency. There needs to be more transparency around what the real cost of the healthcare system is. That's the only way in which we're all going to be able to figure out which are the best technologies to invest in and which are the best technologies to leave behind, because we need to know what the real price is so we can figure out what the real cost benefit is to the system. So transparency, and I personally think there's an overdue opportunity for stakeholders in the system, private and government, to be sitting together to think about what is the regulatory reform that's needed here in the US to make it easier for this market to innovate and create competition in the marketplace.
You want more regulatory reform in the states. Since we're on that topic, how do you feel about the Affordable Care Act and what is being done actually in this country now as it rolls out five years on?
Certainly from my perspective, the Affordable Care Act has simply accelerated some of the trends which were already happening in many regards within the US system. So to really point to a couple of very specific areas, the creation and the encouragement of accountable care organizations. I think this is a really pivotal change in the way healthcare will be delivered over the next 10 or 15 years. And I think really likely to be a good change in the sense that it will start to move people to be judged, measured, and rewarded for the quality of the outcome. The number one, the clinical quality of the outcome. So are people really getting better quicker? Are we seeing better treatments? And then, of course, number two, the cost of the outcome. So this creation of accountable care organizations is a key change. The problem is that some of the regulatory systems haven't caught up with that change. So as the system starts to move towards the direction that the Affordable Care Act requires, there's going to need to be reform of the whole system so that the efficiency and the transparency really plays through.
You talked about R&D a little bit and how you're working to cut costs in R&D. How are you doing that, and how is that translating into what I have to pay when I go to the drugstore?
Right. So in terms of reducing costs of R&D, lots of things we're trying to do, of course. The number one thing, and not to sound too simplistic about it, is the best way to reduce costs of pharmaceutical R&D is to fail less often. R&D in pharmaceuticals is incredibly difficult. A lot of people compare it to putting man on the moon. At least we can see the moon. Unfortunately, in pharmaceuticals, we're dealing with things you can't see. It's incredibly complex. And the amount of failure in this regard is inevitably enormous. So if we can find ways to reduce the amount of failure, then the price of or the cost of the successes goes down.
Does it make sense to you that consumers have to pay for your failures?
I think inevitably somebody has to pay for the failures, I'm afraid. I know it sounds weird, but you do that in most other industries. So let me give you an example. In the car industry, the automobile industry, you don't think that you're paying for the failures, but of course you are. All of the prototypical technologies that Ford or General Motors develop before they actually launch, let's say the new hybrid car, is all embedded in the cost that you pay. The difference between engineering and discovery is in engineering, maybe you fail one in three times. In discovery, you fail 99 out of 100 times. You are really trying to push the limits. To give you a real example, we're working diligently on Alzheimer's disease. I think everybody in America knows that's an area we need to make progress. But really nobody even today knows what the true cause of Alzheimer's is. There's no good animal model to experiment in before you go to humans. These are incredibly complex areas. It truly is a black box. Now, we all know it's incredibly critical to get there. Think about what we're dealing with, the human brain. The human brain, if you unpacked it into computers, the computers to drive a human brain would consume the space of the building we're sat in today. That's what we're trying to navigate. That's why failure is inevitable. And it has to be paid for if you want to encourage shareholders to put their risk capital at stake. If you want a shareholder to invest in a high-risk project which might well fail, then they have to be confident that somehow there's going to be a compensation at the end.
Which I understand. Where do you draw the line, though, between shareholder compensation and access to a better life? I mean, not to get all grand.
Well,
about
you
it,
have to achieve that. You have to achieve both. Clearly, I mean, it cannot be one or the other. And at GSK, we have an absolute twin pillar set of goals, which is innovation and access. It has to be the both. And by the way, not just access in rich countries like the US, but access globally. It's not just for the rich 600 million people in the world. It's for all 7 billion people in the world, which is why we've led the way in the developing world in terms of how we try and create greater access to medicine. How we tackle that is let's reform the way we do R&D. Again, as I said earlier on, we've been working hard over the last several years. Translation of that improved performance is the last six new medicines we've launched here in America, which now count for about 20% of our sales, were launched in the US at or below the prices of the technologies that we're replacing. So we're showing that we can pass forward, reduce costs to the system as a consequence of that improvement. Secondly, we need to be developing more fundamental treatments which don't just treat, but potentially cure people. And there's a generation of technology coming in areas such as cell and gene therapy where the potential for essentially functional cures is beginning to become clear. So possibly in some diseases, being able to manage disease just with one or two treatments in a patient's life. That won't be for everybody. It won't be for everything. But it's a kind of direction where we could see huge potential financial benefits for the system.
Where is the growth for you? Is it here in the States and in Western Europe in developed markets? Or do you need to go to, you know, Southeast Asia and South America and those places to find the next place where you guys are going to be able to get bigger?
Well, GSK is already everywhere. So we're in pretty much every country you can be in globally. But every marketplace is very different, of course. The US remains the most pro-innovation environment in the world, I would say. So the people of the US and the systems of the US strive and demand more and more innovation. Other parts of the world are looking at, they're much less well-developed than the United States. They're looking at much more volume supply for less complex disease. For GSK, we're trying to tackle both of those things.
Let's take an example that's been in the news of late, in the last year, year and a half or so. Ebola and the Zika virus and vaccines and preventions and cures for those. How do we get companies like yours to really plow money into an underserved area?
Well, so we've been involved, since I've been CEO, we've been involved in the swine flu pandemic crisis, the Ebola crisis. Before I took over, the company was involved in the anthrax scares. So we've been pretty much involved in every one of these issues that's come along. And we've thrown everything we could at it. I can tell you, in the case of the swine flu epidemic, we created something like 450 million doses of vaccine in a period of about 6 weeks. And that was against a normal annual production of all of our vaccines of only around 700-800 million. So enormous dedication to make that happen. We were one of the leading three companies in the Ebola vaccine, and we were the first to deploy a candidate vaccine for Ebola into West Africa 18 months ago. So we've been there, and we've always made clear we'll do whatever's necessary in these situations. Having said all of that, the world is not doing a great job of this stuff. There is too much complexity and not enough forward planning for these events. So when an event like Ebola comes along, it's a crisis. It shouldn't be the crisis that it is at the moment. We've made a very clear proposal to a variety of governments around the world that what needs to happen now is there needs to be a public-private partnership between companies like GSK and other vaccine manufacturers to work together in peacetime so that we have more vaccines ready, more capacity dedicated, so that the next time something comes along, we can move much more quickly. If what we're proposing had been in place before Ebola, we could have had vaccine into Africa 6 months quicker than it actually happened. Now, in the course of a pandemic, where whether you win or lose is going to be determined over the weeks that you react, that kind of time gain is enormous. The other thing I would say to you is when you look at our efforts in Ebola, that was a completely non-for-profit exercise from GSK, so we made no return from that.
Let me pick up on that for a minute. I mean, how willing are you to sacrifice profit and the bottom line for the greater good, I suppose?
I think at GSK, we've got an impeccable record for that, actually. Of course, we make an economic return for our shareholders. Sometimes we, and I particularly, have been criticized for not making a strong enough economic return for our shareholders. But we've balanced that economic return with a series of commitments, for example, in Ebola, where we didn't ask any questions. We have been paid no money for all of the research and development work we did for our Ebola vaccine. And another example, malaria. We spent 30 years developing the world's first vaccine for malaria. It's just been approved for deployment in Africa. And we've made a promise that despite the $500 million we've invested over that 30-year period, we will never seek to make a profit from that product. So that will always be a non-for-profit program. And there are many other examples like that within the company at GSK. Now, of course, that does dilute the shareholder return from the company. Of course it does, versus a company that only cares about today's sales and profits. My business has been in existence for 300 years. And the reason it's been here for 300 years is it's found a way through different eras to balance the needs of its owners, its employees, its customers, and the broader society we operate in. And you have to have that approach. Now, it does mean that in any given quarter, you may not be the top performer and you may not keep everybody super happy who are only focused on the financial side of the business. But in the overall scheme of businesses like pharmaceutical companies, which sit somehow on the line between the public and the private sector, I think it's incredibly important that we balance that ownership need, employee need, patient need, and society need.
When you hear GlaxoSmithKline and other pharmaceutical manufacturers, when you hear them lumped in together and referred to as big pharma, much as you hear big oil or you used to hear big tobacco, do you hear that as a pejorative?
No, not really, because Big Pharma brings with it a lot of good things as well as some of the criticisms. And I think we have to keep that in balance. Big Pharma, over the last 100 years, has contributed alongside clean water and improved food to a doubling of life expectancy. Big Pharma has eradicated a wide number of infectious disease through vaccine technology development. Big Pharma is making enormous progress on oncology life expectancy as we speak, and it will be Big Pharma who develop the treatments for Alzheimer's and others going forward. It's the research houses that these companies do that can only those companies have the scale to do the kind of research that goes on. To my knowledge, almost no drugs have ever been discovered and developed by anything other than a pharmaceutical company. That is the way it works. A lot of people think they come out of universities. Sometimes the ideas do, but the drugs never do. And that's something we should be proud of. What we have to really focus on is making sure that we are also paying just as much attention to the behaviours or the decisions which can put us at odds with society. Because at the core of Big Pharma, there's an enormous amount to be proud of. What we have to be really focused on are those mistakes which get in the way.
You talked about systemic change earlier and how that's really what we need to solve this conundrum of the cost of drugs. Seems to me that you, as a guy who's been in this business for 30 years, who's on his way out, right? You're retiring next March or whatever it is. You could stand up and jump up and down on your desk and people would listen. Why aren't you doing that?
Well, I guess I'm not jumping up and down on my desk, but I'm certainly speaking out. And, you know, over the last, I think most people, if you look back at my career, would say he's the crazy guy who keeps standing up and saying things which aren't necessarily in line with the way of the industry or the behavior of the industry in the past. To give you some examples, first company, I announced the first commitment to pool intellectual property to help improve discovery rates in neglected tropical disease. We're the first company to stop paying our representatives in alignment with the volume that's produced in prescriptions. So the first time to disconnect that relationship. We're the first company to stop paying doctors to speak on behalf of the company. All of those are major changes in the way we operate, and we're trying to signal that we think that's the way the industry should change. We're absolutely committed to that change. And for me, pricing, value for money, and innovation are the next frontier for us to really resolve. But it's those three things together. We need innovation. We have to give you value for money. We have to be grown up about pricing. We have to be working to balance the needs of the owners of companies and the patients and the users of the medicine.
Andrew Witty is the chief executive at GlaxoSmithKline. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. This has been Corner Office from Marketplace. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.